The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is a song that was usually sung at mass meetings. It is a lament about how the African continent was taken by the Europeans. It is a reminder to all and sundry that Africans have no choice but to fight for their land.
Oh, how beautiful it is. The music of South Africa, Gary, that's where it was. Not in China, but China and South Africa share a very interesting statistic. Both countries are experiencing the most protests of any country in the world, about 10,000 protests a year and maybe more against a lack of delivery of services, corruption, and other problems. So South Africa and China are in this contest, which none of us really know about. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your news dissector. I'm the editor of MediaChannel.org. And the author of NewsDissector.com, which is my daily blog on the internet, which you can check out, where I try to dissect the news, talk about not just what's in the news, but what's missing from the news. And I'll be talking about my blog today in a few minutes. But first, I wanted to start with that South African song to report that for the last 6 weeks I've been in Africa. In South Africa, I did a little stop at the Zanzibar International Film Festival. I was a judge there. Tremendous films and documentaries and movies from Africa of the kind we never see in this country. And it was really a thrill to meet with artists, musicians, and filmmakers on this island of Zanzibar off the coast of Tanzania, a beautiful place, the Isle of Cloves, it's called. At one point, the U.S. government feared that it would become another Cuba back in the 60s and did everything it could to destroy the movements there that were trying to get autonomy or independence for Zanzibar. Zanzibar is made up of a great cultural mix. It's a very diverse place with people of Arab descent, people of African descent, people of other cultures as well. And it was a fascinating opportunity to connect with people from other cultures and other countries of the kind that we rarely get exposed to in our diversity-less media in America, where all the same stories are run all the time in the same way. So, you know, a year ago, in a very hot summer here, a very cold winter there, I was in South Africa almost every day watching the World Cup games in my living room. Suddenly, and after many years of our media's inattention, the spectacle thrust that beloved country back into global consciousness. This year, those cameras were largely gone, except for another sports-related event. The coverage of a meeting of the International Olympic Committee, which I went to, was headed by a man who, South African, who had spent 20 years fighting to isolate apartheid South Africa from international sports competitions. He was successful, and now he was chairing the meetings. I was back there to help out a local film company, hang out with some old friends, do some writing about a country whose fight for freedom I served as a participatory journalist. I first went there as a student anti-apartheid activist in 1967, and then spent 30 years writing, researching, and doing solidarity work, trying to contribute whatever skills I had to assist the process of on and off change that seemed to take forever until its pace picked up with the release of Nelson Mandela. I helped direct 6 films about Mandela's passage from prisoner to the presidency, and was back as frequently as I could be to follow up, to stay engaged with one of the few successful revolutions, if that's what it was, in my lifetime. South Africa's late poet laureate, Masisi Kuneni, who taught at UCLA for many years, told me once that the victories there were mine as well. I don't think I could have made that claim, but he made it on my behalf. So I jumped at the opportunity to go back there this past summer to see what I could see, drink as many of the locally produced appetizer drinks as I could, and get a sense of where things were going as this country continues to become what they once pined for, a normal country. Apartheid is gone, but in many ways it lives on and the enormous gaps that remain between the rich, which now include a black elite, and the poor. Normality lives on in stories about pervasive corruption that eats at the soul of the movement, which sacrificed for the change that is both visible and incomplete as the economy falters, protests mount, and political acrimony bursts off the pages of every newspaper. As a blogger and writer, I paid attention to what I was seeing, who I was meeting, and how I was thinking. My tone is no longer as celebratory as it may have been in the early days of the transition when Mandela was elected. Even though I don't live there, I'm proudly South African in the sense that my hopes still higher than hope for the success of this great experiment in democracy. At the same time, I can't stand by and not speak out against trends and problems that are threatening to tear that hope apart. And I want to just quote for you one of my favorite South African writers, who, if you don't know, you should find out about, Njabulo Ndebele. He writes about some of these issues, and I'm going to be publishing with coaltype.net a collection of the articles I wrote in South Africa, some of which appeared on the PRN website. And he writes, he says, "We can see the exponential threats all around us, the decayed schooling system, the high probability of syndicated crime close to the center of the national police and intelligence systems, the unanswered public concerns that are there about the national defense forces, the decline in our continental and global prestige, the widespread protests of disillusionment, the stasis of vision in the annual drama of uncritical conflict between employers and the trade union movement, and the phenomena of organized political youth making demands whose sources are understandable, but under circumstances in which they become no more than a threat multiplier. For years, I worried about South Africa's future. Now I worry for it. I'm still in awe of the committed journalists and academics who speak out, and the many activists at the community level who struggle there for fairness and equality. Has visionary politics in South Africa ended, or will its voices rise again to edify and inspire us? I hope that will happen. I fear that it won't, but I hope it will. And I wanted to just bring you some of my feelings about South Africa, because it's very important, as all of you remember how you felt when Nelson Mandela was released, when he came to New York City, when he packed Yankee Stadium. He said, "I am a Yankee." You know, he spoke in Harlem. Winnie Mandela spoke with the Malcolm X's widow, Betty Shabazz. It was a moment of great joy at a time when there wasn't so much joy. And, you know, we remember that. We admire Mandela, but we also worry about what's going to happen in and to South Africa, and I wanted to share that with you. Having said all of that and given you this little short report on my visit, I want to segue now into the economic crisis here in America, which, of course, I have been very concerned about and have done a film, Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, and a book, The Crime of Our Time, about.
They're overseas. Job creator, won't you? Job creator, won't you? Job creator, yeah, just buy up everything, like cars and diamond rings and second homes. But job creator, won't you leave our English language alone? Well, I used to tell your daddy that kid will be no good.
Well, it's a neat little song, Job Creator, which Sherry Welch sent to me. It's on YouTube. You can check it out. It springs off of a comment by John Stewart, where he talked about how rich people today are now being called job creators. If that's their role in the economy, the only problem, of course, is that no jobs are being created. So we have this delusion somehow that the wealthy are going to save us, when in fact what the wealthy seem to be doing is transferring as much wealth as they can from us to them, through various techniques and various methods. We're now facing a very dangerous time in the history of the Republic. You may have been following this, you may not, but of course we're involved in a war in Washington, not only just a political war, but an economic war. It's a war about whether the debt ceiling will be raised or whether the United States will in effect default on its obligations, which could, you know, throw the system into a tailspin, not only in this country, but in other countries, because so many people, especially China, has invested so much in our own country. So this battle in Washington is a very significant one. And I write about it on my blog at newsdissector.com today, comparing the Republicans who are trying to oppose the extension of the debt ceiling to kamikaze pilots. Those are the pilots that the Japanese deployed that turned their planes into bombs, sacrificing themselves in the name of the emperor in a holy war against U.S. ships. They would aim for the deck of aircraft carriers and do as much damage as they could at a cost of their equipment and their lives. Guerrilla armies refine the tactic and make it less pricey. Much lower cost suicide belts with explosives are now being used by individuals to terrorize their enemies without having to sacrifice weapon systems. But now American politics has spawned its own kamikazes in the persona of ultra-right-wing fanatics in suits who are ready to blow up the world financial system if they don't get their way. And unfortunately, as you've heard on Gary's program and you're reading in the press, our president is making deals with them. He's trying to stop this from happening by essentially compromising, conceding, some feel selling out to the Republicans in order to make a deal, a grand deal is what he's calling it. However, many people are very worried about it, because this game of high-stakes poker there is likely to not only take away our benefits, deep cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, with no immediate revenue increases. Now, that's deeply troubling. The Democratic base is furious about this. MoveOn has denounced Obama. So have many progressive Democrats in Congress who say he's negotiating without them. He's making deals that he shouldn't be making. Robert Reich, who was the Labor Secretary under Bill Clinton, compares Obama to Clinton, saying this is what Clinton did. He triangulated. He basically became a Republican to fight the Republicans, and he was reelected. So this is something that Obama's is a lesson that Obama is attempting to emulate. The problem, of course, is that we're in a situation now, which is very unlike 1996 when Clinton pulled this off. These are not Clinton times. And Reich writes, he says, when the Great Recession wiped out $7.8 trillion of home value, it crushed the nest eggs, eliminated the collateral of America's middle class. As a result, consumer spending has been decimated. We're in a vicious cycle in which jobs and wage losses further reduce America's willingness to spend, which slows the economy. Job growth has effectively stopped. The population now working is near a 25-year low, lower than it was when the recession officially ended in June 2009. So what are we going to do about that, folks? How are we going to understand what's happening in Washington and how it's going to affect our lives? This is an issue I'd hope to have some more time to explore, but I call your attention to my piece. It's on Common Dreams. It's on a number of websites. It's also available at newsdissector.com. I'd like your comments on it, your reactions to it. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. Any thoughts you might have about the economy. We're going to come back in a few minutes and meet a man who's going to tell us that senior citizens in America have become, believe it or not, the next group that's being victimized by AIDS. And we're going to hear what he has to say, and then we're going to close out with some comments from Aaron Crown of the ML-implode websites that have been tracking the economy every week. Aaron has been on with me before to monitor this and to offer some truth about the economy that we're not getting in our press, not getting in our newspapers, not getting in our magazines. The economy, the state of the economy, the state of our country, the state of our culture is not good.
What's the hurry? Why the worry? All the dreams you chased now seem so far away. The race was rigged, I heard today. Bankers won it anyway. What's new? The middle class is screwed. So sad but true. Sucks to be you. Breaking news is all over my space. All the Twitter about Facebook fantasies. And the world cries out for Novocaine. The rich refuse to share the pain. They took a cruise, we paid the dues. Class warfare blues. The captains cry for more rewards, throwing their crews overboard. A hotter sun begins to burn the sails. As we sail the mighty bankruptcies, we praise the Lord we were born free. Should we put our faith in Him or private jails? If all else fails, now the high priest up on Wall Street, by the government for just their chosen few. But they took a loan we can't forgive. We'll all be lucky if we live this through. What we gonna do? Better change the rules and fire these fools. As the captains cry for more reward, they're throwing their crews overboard. A hotter sun begins to burn the sails. No time left for compromise. We better learn to localize. The only way we're gonna make it through. Status quo won't do. It's up to me and you. Me and you.
Radio Network celebrating 5 years of independent news.
To the Progressive Radio Network, and you know what that means? It means you, my friend, are an informed individual, and we thank you.
I'm Elaine Schnepfe, host producer of Evolving Ideas, Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, and global on the Internet. Join me each week on the Progressive Radio Network to explore the universe and our relationship to it.
Join us, Bruce and Marianne Curtis, Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network for Truth and Freedom. We present provocative conversations with the world's most brilliant minds in the areas of holistic health, spiritual wisdom, politics, and a host of other topics. Some of our topics include the latest work in non-invasive therapy on the brain, the truth beneath the global economic meltdown, healing power of the breath, and the sublime truth beyond all religious traditions. In this age of transformation, we need to look beneath the surface appearance of things to see the underlying reality. From material that is always illuminating and often liberating, tune in to Truth and Freedom on the Progressive Radio Network Fridays at 3 p.m.
Hey, Lee.
Yeah, Jeff.
Your girlfriend gave another interview.
No, 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 don't play it.
Listen to this.
I have a journalism degree. That is what I studied. I understand that this cornerstone of our democracy is a free press.
Shut it off. I said not to play it.
We are in the worst reality show in history.
Why won't she shut up?
You know she's going to be president, right?
Okay, stop it. That's not funny. That's not funny.
I think we should just go limp. Lay back. Maybe then the mama grizzly won't tear off their limbs.
Cheater in the Rood. Thursdays, 8 p.m. Progressive Radio Network.
You are listening to Progressive Radio Network.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express and Visa Morgan Stanley too. In debt we trust, so pay we must, we owe it all to you.
Well, that's the anthem from my film In Debt We Trust. It's about who really runs this country, the big banks. And, it, you know, it tells us a little bit about who we should be appraising in a way, because they're the ones putting up the money and controlling the economy. You know, the crisis that we've been discussing, that I've been detailing, I started in 2005 analyzing all of this. My film, In Debt We Trust, came out 2006. I was called an alarmist, a doom and gloomer, didn't know what I was talking about. Then suddenly, 6 months later, the market melted down. Bear Stearns went down. Suddenly, I was went from being a zero to a hero. I'm a genius now for having predicted the financial crisis. Of course, I was hardly the only one, although there weren't very many people who were calling attention to these crises. Now, fast forward 2007, 2011. Where are we now? And what we're finding is, first of all, that the foreclosure crisis is worse than ever. Florida foreclosure fraud investigators are saying the attorney general there fired them for aggressively pursuing the banks. Paul Krugman, who's been very, I would say, sort of center left, is now writing about letting the bankers walk, saying that this failure to seek real mortgage relief early in the Obama administration is one reason we still don't have, we still have 9% unemployment. And he makes a connection between unemployment and foreclosures. This is a crisis that we'll come back to. Aaron Crown of the website ML Implode is going to join us in a little bit. Sorry if the program seems a little convoluted today. This is what happens when you come from the winter in South Africa to the hot summer in New York. Your mind begins to go south, north, east, and west all at the same time. At any rate, I was struck by a very interesting story, and we reached Larry Siebert, who works for a company that is connected to this story that you'll be interested in. I didn't realize this, but apparently senior citizens in America are now having their own AIDS epidemic. And that older people who we didn't think were at risk of AIDS are now at risk of AIDS. So, Larry Siebert, can you first tell us a little bit about that, and then we can talk about your testing devices?
Sure, I'd be glad to. Thanks for having me on. The story about HIV and people that are at risk of it is that some 20 or 25% of the people in the United States who are believed to be infected are not aware, or that are infected are not aware that they are. So we have about 1.2 million people that are infected, and some 200,000 to 300,000 are not aware of the fact that they are infected. And that the population of unawareness, if you will, spans from the teenagers to people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Tell us about that. I mean, the older people, maybe because I'm ancient myself, Larry, I'm sort of about to keel over here. What is it about older people that they just don't think it could happen to them?
Well, people at various points in their life can have multiple sexual partners and may not be aware or informed enough to engage in safe sex practices, and so that is a risk factor that can result in an unfortunate situation. People as they get older, as we know, sometimes do change lose their spouse and then start dating, and those are the kinds of things that can or get divorced, obviously, so those are the kinds of things that can happen. And it's become I don't have the specific data in front of me today, but it's become a well-established fact that this population segment, like other population segments, is at risk.
So one of the things that you are sort of involved in and recommending is a kind of rapid HIV testing methodology, so that people don't have to wait for a long time to get tested and to get results. These rapid tests exist. They can give results in as little as 15 minutes, I'm told. Do you want to tell us about that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So Chembio, and we have information on our website, chembio.com, chembio.com, is a manufacturer of two FDA-approved rapid HIV tests. And we have a new one that is now in clinical trials that should be approved around the middle of next year. And they all test for antibodies to HIV, so that within a few weeks of somebody becoming infected, their body will create antibodies as an immune response. As most of us know, unfortunately, those antibodies are not effective in eradicating the disease like many other antibodies are. So it's important to be tested early, because the earlier you tested, the better chance you have of availing yourself of the antiretroviral therapeutics. And these tests work similar to a home pregnancy test. So far, the tests that we have in the market are not available to consumers like pregnancy tests are, if you went to the drugstore, to CVS.
So you can only get them through your doctor, basically.
Through doctor, through public testing clinics, okay. Planned Parenthood, other outreach clinics, community-based organizations, also hospitals.
One last question here, Larry. I just came back from Africa. There's been a big controversy about the AIDS pandemic in Africa, whether or not the testing, is basically accurate. And some of it is based on statistical projections that have been questioned in terms of the scale of the AIDS epidemic there. And so testing is something that's very important, needless to say. Do you think that this new testing device will help people get treatment earlier, or at least some intervention to keep them alive?
Oh, yeah. In my humble opinion, I don't think there's any question that testing is a critical aspect of prevention. If for no other reason, and this doesn't necessarily relate to seniors, although I do believe that testing should be done on seniors as well, but the most well-established prevention program in Africa, talking about Africa, is for pregnant women to be tested, because it's well-established that women who are pregnant and test positive for HIV can take a certain type of drug, I forget how to pronounce it now, but it is
Novarine or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, to prevent transmission of the virus to the unborn child.
Larry, we're moving along rather rapidly here, but listen, I want to thank you for coming on. We had a couple of problems in reaching you. Maybe they were our fault. I'm sorry. But
no problem.
Just give us your website one more time.
Sure. It's Chembio, C-H-E, M as in Mary, B-I-O, like chemistry, biology, chembio.com.
Okay. Larry Siebert, thank you so much for coming on. I'm going to raise this with Gary Knoll, who's been following these issues. He might have a contrary view. I don't know. But I certainly felt it was interesting to know about this, that senior citizens are also at risk from of AIDS, and something that is an issue that hasn't been discussed very much, and you've heard about it here. Thank you so much. Okay.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Larry. Now, segueing back to the financial crisis, which I've been covering like a glove, you know, following this in all of its machinations and all of its problems. And now we're at a stage where we have not only high unemployment, not only continued, foreclosures that are rapid, not only a lack of job creation, but also this battle in Washington about whether or not the debt ceiling will be raised. And, you know, Republicans saying that it shouldn't be raised unless the government basically agrees to cut all sorts of programs that lower the debt. You know, of course, in discussing all of this, they never talk about what drove up the debt in the first place, like the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, among other things. But instead, you know, they want to cut all entitlement programs and basically don't seem to be too concerned about people who are living on, you know, government benefits, or they would have nothing to live on at all. Anyway, joining me now is an economist of maybe another political persuasion. I don't really know. It doesn't really matter. He's somebody who has done a great job of analyzing the financial situation and the corporate situation. Aaron Crown of the ML-Implode websites, which if you don't know about them, you should. They have a new upgraded website that you can sign up for, and we'll tell you how in a few minutes. Hi, Aaron. Long time no speak. Where do you see
us? Hi, Danny. Welcome back.
Yeah. Where do you see us going now with this battle royale in Washington?
Well, they're gonna raise it eventually. I mean, you gotta understand that Washington is a machine that works a certain way, and the momentum in going that direction is only increasing. So it's not going to change, and it's controlled by the money that controls the politicians, and that money demands that the spigots of money that flow back to them continue. So, you know, they will find a way. But I think what you said about the nature of the debt, you know, and there's this philosophy of odious debt that I think is important, and that those questions are not being asked. You know, was it legitimate where all this debt came from, and is it legitimate for it to be the burden to be on the public and for the public to for basic public services to take the first cuts? So those are important questions in my mind.
Well, you know, I mean, I did this film In Debt We Trust, talking about the debt issue, except I talked about a slightly different debt issue. That is the debt issue that all of us confront, you know, as we struggle to pay off our credit card bills, our student loans, our car loans, and our mortgages. In that case, one of the first, you know, I spotlighted the subprime crisis early on back in 2006, before it was being talked about very widely as an example of predatory lending, you know, lending to people who they knew couldn't afford these loans, and yet they did it so that they could really, in essence, repackage, resell, and make money from these homes until the people were forced out. So it's, you know, it's a crisis that's still with us, that's getting deeper, it seems like. But that loan crisis, the consumer debt, is not something they're talking about. They're talking about the government debt. And the suggestion, of course, is that Democrats, all they want to do is spend more money, slather, you know, federal programs all over the country irresponsibly and the like, and that the only way to stop them is to cut off basically the money and stop the United States from borrowing more money, you know, this whole debt ceiling, and let the consequence be what they may. If we default,
well,
the problem.
You know, there's a problem here. Then a lot of the so-called stimulus payments programs is actually just emergency welfare and emergency support to, you know, the working poor and the newly working poor now in this economic depression. And it's not really being discussed that wasn't stimulus. That was just what we essentially had to do as a society to stay afloat. And so there's not a lot to cut back in terms of social services. I mean, they've been mucking with the inflation statistics for years, and, you know, they've got grandma and grandpa on the verge of eating dog food here, Even Obama's talking about distorting the inflation statistics more in their Social Security payouts. So, you know, it really is a situation where there's not a lot more to cut back. You know, we've seen what the extreme austerity has led to in Greece. Here, it's less a matter of the average Joe being dependent on government programs and more a matter of things like Social Security, unemployment support, you know, the temporary assistance for families. That stuff's not stimulus, but if you start to cut it back, it's really going to look ugly.
Yeah, it's
the shock therapy just does not work.
It's not cutting into the into the meat. It's cutting into the bone,
exactly.
And it's affecting people who can ill afford to be affected. So I mean, the consequences.
Well, I agree with you. I would like to see some austerity for defense contractors. You know, how about that?
You also used the word before in passing, Aaron, that I have to ask you to explain. I mean, you know, we've heard a lot about this great recession, this temporary recession, this recovery that's supposed to be happening, and yet you used the word economic depression. Now, this is not a term that's used very much in our media, but it seems to me all the trends and statistics seem to add up to another massive depression in America. True or not?
Yeah, I think it surely is. A depression is when the level of the economy, it's like a reverse plateau. It goes down, and you can have recoveries and recessions within that depression, like we did during the Great Depression. But when the real level of output of your economy gaps down and stays down for a long time, and when it refuses to generate more jobs, that's a depression. And the real test is just think about if we didn't have those emergency programs, if we didn't do, you know, if we had soup lines instead of foods, and if we had job lines instead of, you know, the unemployment, the extended unemployment, think about what things would look like. And I think we'd be getting the same pictures that we all, you know, that haunt us from the Great Depression. So it, to me, you know, pretty clear that it is a depression, and I think it will help us a lot in dealing with it if we start to acknowledge that.
Well, a little honesty never hurts, but it does seem to be out of favor, not just among the Republicans, but among the Democrats as well, who are really invested in, you know, attempting to portray something bad as something good. You know, we heard a song before about how being rich today, you know, you're really a job creator if you're wealthy, whether or not you create any jobs, of course. So, I mean, this is the use of language to obscure reality, to actually give us, deceive us about what's going on. And here we have a situation which seems to go from bad to worse, and there's been so little response to it. I don't really get why.
Yeah, that's what happens when the leaders, so-called leaders, don't acknowledge what the situation really is. And that tends to cause it to go from bad to worse, and so of course we're seeing renewed economic downturn and misery out there, and it's you know, reflecting back into the political echo chamber. But it's just sad that, you know, we could have started acknowledging this 2 or 3 years ago.
It's also true that most Americans have no clue about how what happens here affects people in other countries, and how this ripples out, you know, and the people who are living, you know, on $2 a day are now living on $1 a day because of this financial crisis. Certainly in South Africa, when I was there a few years ago, I was assured this will not affect us in any way. Well, guess what? The South African banks also invested in these subprime mortgage bonds. They lost a ton of money. And now South Africa's unemployment rate has climbed steadily ever upwards. So, you know, they too are affected by this because we're in a globalized economy.
Exactly.
What happens here happens there in a way. Maybe not exactly in the same way, but it does happen, and it does impact on people's lives who had nothing to do with this in the first place. They don't even know what's hitting them, basically. They don't know about speculation in food and commodities. They don't know about speculation in oil, why everything costs more today, you know, how it's being driven by, you know, these processes of investors and speculators and the like. And the consequence of this is that you know, it's very hard to talk about these issues when people are so distracted away from it, you know, who are talking about J-Lo, you know, they're not talking about, you know,
well, and when they, when the money that controls the politics is in favor of as much globalization as they can achieve, but really, I mean, I personally think that both financially and in terms of trade, we became excessively globalized because of that feedback between the world's mega corporations and banks and the powerful governments. That's going to have to reverse. I mean, economies are going to have to become more localized. You know, it's more efficient and sustainable. And I think, you know, we will, as a society and a polity, end up there kicking and screaming, but it's going to have to happen.
Yeah, and clearly, you know, the outsourcing of jobs, the, you know, investments by American corporations and enterprises in other countries have had a negative effect. Even though a lot of them have a lot of money, they're sitting on piles of capital. They're not investing it in jobs in America. They're not hiring people. As a consequence, you know, job creation is a joke right now. So this is something that we really need to get our, you know, heads around and try to understand. Now, I'm trying to do it, as you know, Aaron, not too successfully. I don't think any of us who are trying to do it have been successful enough. But, you know, my film Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, plunderthecrimeofourtime.com, is an effort to try to educate people about this issue. We are going to be showing it at the Henry George School on 30th Street in Manhattan tomorrow at 4 o'clock. We're doing screenings everywhere we can. If you're interested in screening the film, if you're interested in hearing more, checking out my book, for example, The Crime of Our Time, which is a companion to the film, which goes into more detail. Checking out Aaron's website, mlimplode.com. Tell us about your new web project there, Aaron.
Yeah, I have a spinoff, ML Explode, and it's basically focusing on the restructure and reform of the mortgage industry. And I'm intending that to be both a consumer and industry site. So check that out if you're interested. We still haven't solved the problem in housing finance in this country, and we don't know what we're going to get. And I think that anyone who's interested in that needs to speak out, and I hope my site becomes a venue for that, and we can help shape that for something, to create something that's more sustainable and healthy for society.
Well, again, I mean, the work you're doing, I'm very supportive of. I think it's very important. And I think, you know, it's up to us really to check out these sources, to try to get more information, to get better informed. You can write to me at Dissector.
Let me just add that people from the government and other powerful sources, they do read these sites. I know they read them, and you'll hear from other contrarian and independent bloggers out there that they do get visitors from the government and from these other sources that are influential. So it does actually get back to them. So, you know, make your voice heard and weigh in any way you can.
Okay. Well, let me just finish up my little program here. NewsDissector.com is my blog. DissectorMediaChannel.org is my email address. A podcast of this program will be available on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com site. It will also be posted in my blog so that you can check it out and listen to it again and pass it on to your friends. So thanks for listening. It's your News Dissector, Danny Schechter, back in action here, back on PRN. Hopefully we'll hear from you. If you like the program, if you have suggestions for guests, please get in touch with me at DissectorMediaChannel.org. We're going out now with the theme song of Plunder, a crime of our time.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got dulled. When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off, workers laid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets and empty shops, and bank walking in AAA.